I'd say in 18th century terms, it's quite diverse, simply for the reason that there are people of different races that actually live together in villages. So you have Native Americans, a variety of different groups or nations, and then you have Europeans, mostly of French descent, but not exclusively. And then you have mixed race people who are most likely the offspring of French men and Native American women. And then Africans who are mostly there as slaves. So it's, compared to most of the colonial world, it's quite diverse.
How did that commingling create a distinct culture in the region?
Well, what it did was it forced different groups to make some adaptations to each other that really wasn't the general rule in the colonial world, particularly in North America. It had mostly been a zero-sum game where Europeans pushed up against Native Americans, and violence wasn't always what ensued, but displacement was far more likely than cooperation. So in the Illinois country, where you had people who had reasons, mostly doing business, trading with each other, they had reasons to coexist, so therefore they actually needed to adapt to each other to some degree, which again wasn't the case farther east or at other points in the colonial Western Hemisphere.
And the reasons centered on the fur trade.
Yeah, the fur trade was actually interesting. We don't always think of it this way, but it gave Europeans and Native Americans sort of a reason to coexist and cooperate. It was a win-win situation. So that changed the whole dynamic from what it was in most areas, particularly the Eastern Seaboard, we're most familiar with, whereby Native Americans were simply in the way and white Europeans wanted their land. They didn't mind doing some business with them, and they often took a crack at missionary work, at trying to convert them to Christianity, but mostly they wanted them out of the way. So the fur trade gave both Europeans and Native Americans a reason to want to cooperate.
This is not an entirely dependable reason, because you have different groups of Europeans who were seeking different economic outcomes for their business opposition.
Yeah, and that begins to change by the middle of the 18th century, because you then have, rather than either missionaries or fur traders penetrating the continent, you begin to have settlers and land speculators who cross the Appalachian Mountains into the interior, what we'd call today's Midwest, touching on the area that I call the Illinois country. And they do have different motives. And again, they're less concerned with the animals on the land than with the land itself.
You have different sovereignties over the area. You have French, you have Spanish, you have back to French, and you have back to Spanish. And then finally, you have the U.S. But that's perhaps a little misleading. You note in the book that it's really more like city-states. Describe how lightly ownership by the nation-states rested on the area.
Yeah, well, sovereignty is often something of a presumption, particularly in the colonial period, where you have imperial groups who are far away, sometimes thousands of miles away, presuming to rule over an area where they really can't project power. So the deeper you get into the interior of North America, the more problematic it is to think in terms of the French Empire is doing this or the British Empire is doing that. Instead, conditions on the ground, local conditions, often dictate self-rule to some degree. Not that things, decisions made and actions taken by imperial powers didn't matter, but they often didn't matter in a direct way as much as we might think.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with John Rita, the author of a new book out from Northern Illinois University Press, From Furs to Farms. He's a historian who's a professor at Illinois State University. McLean County was dominated by the Kickapoo. The Quad Cities area around Rock Island had the Sauk and Fox. You identify the key group in the entire region as the Osage Nation. Tell us a little bit about them and their impact on trade and European development.
Well, the Osage, they're sort of fated by their geography, that they're in the middle of the Mississippi Valley. mostly to the west of the Mississippi in what we would think of today as southeastern Missouri and central Missouri, northern Arkansas. And so they're really a little bit in between European empires, where they're not directly in contact with the Spanish, but they're in contact with Plains Indian groups who are doing business with the Spanish, particularly the Comanche. They're also in contact with a number of the groups that you mentioned that are more Great Lakes Indian groups. And the Osage, because they have access to French goods and French weapons, they are a pretty coherent group politically for much of this period. They're numerically strong, and they are relatively less impacted by epidemic diseases. So by the early 18th century, they've emerged as a pretty strong, coherent group, well located to have a great deal of influence on the entire region.
Why were they less impacted by epidemics than, say, the Mandans?
Well, the Mandans get in trouble later because they're sedentary. They don't move around. They're in agriculturally based villages. And when Europeans come to visit, it's generally bad news, whether they realize it or not initially. And their population density and their nature as a sedentary group made them more vulnerable. And that's roughly the model. It doesn't explain entirely which groups are affected by European disease. Some of it is just luck of the draw in terms of the vectors of epidemics, what weather might have been like. But for groups that were a little bit more mobile and had less contact with Europeans coming to where they lived, the Osage often went to do business with Europeans in places that weren't their home base, such as in the Illinois country, where they might do business with traders in Cahokia or Kaskaskia, which were located in what's southwestern Illinois today, whereas their villages were across the Mississippi a little bit farther away.
You talked about geography as fate. Well, geography is destiny for the region, too. Talk about the unique position of the Illinois country as a crossroads for the continent and for these competing imperial groups, would you?
Yeah, that's something that really helped draw me into working in this area, because it's, as I say, and I think one of the first sentences in the book or the first paragraph, it's a watery world. This area that's roughly within a 150-mile radius of what is St. Louis today is the confluence of the Mississippi, the Missouri, and the Ohio rivers all come together in a limited geographic area. So these are the superhighways of the colonial world, and this is how people move around. They also, via the Illinois River, have direct access to the Great Lakes. So it's really hard to imagine an area geographically that would have been better suited. And part of the testimony to that is going back several centuries earlier, the large population group that had sprung up around Cahokia several centuries earlier than that.
In our grade school mythmaking, we often approach westward expansion of the U.S. as an inevitability. You in this book are looking at a specific area, as you've just said, with specific processes that yield specific changes, and there's little predestination about it. What are some more of these unique factors and how they shape the transformation of the Mississippi Valley into the transition from furs to farms?
Well, you've got a couple of different moving targets. One of them is the what I think of as lines on a map. What do European powers, and eventually the United States becomes a player, where do they draw lines on a map, and how does that change over time? So by the middle of the 18th century, rather, you have warfare reaching out to this area. So you have changes in sovereignty and lines being redrawn on a map. Then you have the actual land itself and the physical environment, and you have an area that's very, very rich in wildlife, at the end of the 1600s. A century later, much of that wildlife has been depleted, and so the ability to make a living either by trading furs or just by hunting and trapping to sustain yourself, that becomes compromised. And finally, you have changes in demography, which, very roughly speaking, meant that as more English-speaking settlers reached the area, their concern was far more in terms of agriculture, subsistence agriculture, and eventually commercial agriculture, which meant they had very little interest in the animals on the land and very little interest in cooperation with Native Americans or mixed-race peoples. So those three areas, I'd say, were all kind of moving at different rates and different combinations to affect the particular history of the Illinois country.
What made the U.S. more successful than France or Spain in incorporating it into a nation? Was it just the right time for the transition, or was it a different sense of empire? Was it that European population pressure you just mentioned that hadn't existed before in the Mississippi Valley? Was it the right time for the fur trade to collapse? Was it a changing environment? Was it a changing economy? What was it?
Well, I think you provided a pretty good overview there, that there are a number of factors, but I would point mostly to the idea that as an empire, which a number of people still have a problem thinking of the United States as an empire, at least that early on, they were acutely aware that projecting power halfway across the continent was problematic. The early administrations, the Washington, the Adams, the Jefferson, the Madison, Monroe administrations, all had financial constraints that precluded their ability to, you know, manhandle or bully the region militarily. And so there was a far more meaningful feedback loop of input and influence by the settlers themselves. Now, unfortunately for
it
for
was that influence was influenced though by what effectively was a trade representative rather than a governor, though, right?
Well, I think of it more in terms of as white settlers who were at least nominally connected to the United States and that the United States wanted to really consider as their citizens and their representatives, what they wanted from the area was a commercial agriculture economy and essentially a white supremacist political regime as well. And those demands needed to be heeded lest those people take their allegiances elsewhere. We tend to think as that people who moved into the West, and this was the West at that period in time, we think of them as perhaps carrying the flag for the United States. But some of them thought they were leaving somewhere rather than extending somewhere. So various administrations had to pay more attention to what these people wanted. And what they wanted was Native Americans to go away and the land and all political power to go to white people.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking about the book From Furs to Farms by ISU professor and historian John Rita. The land becomes a big issue because you have people of different descents, of different heritages and different cultural backgrounds, and they all have been there for varying periods of time, but they have land. How does the idea of property rights and land ownership get thrashed out over a century or two in terms of these multiple imperial oversights?
Well, it's really a dramatic transformation that takes place in a relatively short period of time. During the 1600s and 1700s, land was plentiful and Native Americans tended to not be concerned with the number of Europeans coming into this region, at least. And the imperial powers essentially were happy wherever people tended to settle, and they made it quite easy to acquire some semblance of title to land. When we get to the post-revolutionary period, The United States embarks upon a very ambitious and far-reaching program of surveying and commodifying land. And that begins with the land ordinances of 1785 and is most famously codified by the Northwest Ordinance. So at that point, you actually have the abrupt end of a casual distribution of land, and you now have very strict surveys, and you're now turning the landscape into the checkerboard that we're all familiar with if we've looked out the window of an airplane on a clear day when we're traveling. And it's not that Europeans never measured land at all or surveyed land, but it was just much less formalized and much less contentious than when the United States began to do that, because people wanted a piece of paper that said, this specific piece of land is mine, and I can borrow against it. I can use it as a form of capital itself, and that was a dramatic transformation.
In the book, you note that the war, or as you put it, the wars of 1812, were not just about maritime trade, impressment, and the other official causes of war. They're about trade hegemony in the interior, in the Illinois country. Enlarge on that, would you?
Yeah, well, you have American business people, American traders, who are quite resentful of the idea that there are still the remnants of the French Empire and the British Empire in this area. And you have people who are doing business, and the benefits of that business are largely being diverted either north into Canada and then to Europe, or down the Mississippi River via New Orleans to Europe. And so there's quite a bit of competition in terms of Americans wanting the Europeans to leave, and also many Americans wanting the fur trade itself to be phased out as quickly as possible, because they wanted, again, to commodify the land and use it for agricultural reasons. So you have an issue there where it's not really a dramatic question of population pressure. It's more the idea that for Americans, Europeans, particularly the British, that were still, in the eyes of Americans, meddling in affairs of the United States in United States territory, fired up Western Americans, people living in Ohio or Kentucky or Tennessee or the territories of Indiana and Illinois, deeply resented the influence of the British, and they tended to blame the British for the degree of resistance that Native Americans had to this sort of takeover of the region. Even though Native Americans had plenty of reasons of their own to act as they did, for many Americans, the resentment was towards European meddling, particularly the British.
The British actually didn't go away even after the War of 1812. You note that they're still active economically in the region into the 1820s.
Yeah, and you know, there's a little backroom dealing going on there whereby particularly John Jacob Astor, who's one of the famous Americans of the period for accumulating one of the largest fortunes of the early national period in the United States, his American Fur Company, as it's called, had a pretty heavy dependence on people who weren't Americans, because they simply had the expertise in the area.